Hello, everyone. This is Bonfire Madigan. We're not crazy. The system is. Tune into the Radical Mental Health Show, hosted by the Freedom Center, Wednesday nights, 6 to 7 p.m. on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM.
Hi, everybody. This is Will Hall with the Radical Mental Health Show, sponsored by the Freedom Center. And tonight we have a show we're going to be, for the holiday seasons, we're going to be focusing on sex work and sex as a symptom, pathologized and as a disease in society, and the way in which sexual norms of what's healthy and what's perverse end up impacting our mental health. And we have two sex workers here, also activists for sex workers' rights. One is in the studio, Katie Simon, and Maurice, who's on the phone calling in from New York City. So we're going to go to that in a few minutes. And I wanted to first of all, welcome people to the show. If you haven't tuned in before, this show is sponsored by the Freedom Center, which is a local Northampton, Massachusetts activism, advocacy, and support network for people who have different mental health diagnoses, who are looking for alternatives and who are looking for human rights. So you can find out more about what we do going to our website, freedom-center.org. We have free acupuncture and yoga in downtown Northampton. We have a support group. We have this radio show. We do a number of public events. So check out our website, freedom-center.org. And I just want to call people's attention. It's really a wonderful the last few days. The December 16th edition of the New York Times had a cover story, and the following two editions had a cover story that were basically featuring Jim Gottstein, who's a lawyer from Alaska who heads psychrights.org. And Jim has been a frequent guest here on the radio show. He's an ongoing collaborator and helper and advocate and ally with the Freedom Center and all our different advocacy work. And to make a long story short, someone leaked to him a bunch of very hot documents from Eli Lilly. And Jim turned around and handed them over to the New York Times, and boom, it's on the cover of the New York Times 2 days in a row. And then the editorial yesterday, the New York Times official editorial, was calling for congressional hearings based on this document, these 300 or something documents that got leaked. Basically, the documents show, some of the things that the documents show are that Eli Lilly actively misled the public and knowingly misled the public in promoting Zyprexa, its leading schizophrenia drug, which accounts for most of its profits, and about 2 million people around the country use, around the world, I think it is, 2 million people use. And remember that Eli Lilly is a huge corporation. This is like the center of global capitalism there. One of the revelations was that they were downplaying the side effects of Zyprexa, its leading, their leading schizophrenia drug, and they were trying to convince people that it wasn't that much of a player in causing diabetes, which of course it is. It's a huge player in causing diabetes, and Eli Lilly knew about that, and they suppressed that information. And then the following day, the New York Times had another cover story about a whole other aspect of Eli Lilly's fraud and corruption, which was that Eli Lilly has been promoting Zyprexa use for off-label use in dementia patients, which is a big no-no. They're completely prohibited from doing that. Check it out. It's at newyorktimes.com. We're also linking it from the Freedom Center website. Those stories, follow that story closely, because it is developing. It's a really great victory for the movement for reforming and changing the mental health system and getting the pharmaceutical companies to be honest about the drugs that they're pushing on people. So it's really great to have Katie Simon back on the show. Katie's been a frequent host of the radio show here in the past. I just want to read her bio before introducing her. Since moving to the Western Massachusetts area at the age of 21, Catherine Simon has worked as an escort and an on and off activist. She worked for the Freedom Center for 3 years, focusing on issues of diagnosing youth, and mostly she has focused her activism in the community low-income rights organization Arise for Social Justice, working on the WISE committee, which works on issues of criminalizing women. She has worked on campaigns to stop prison expansion in Massachusetts and to make needle exchange legal in Springfield and throughout Massachusetts, and also to decriminalize prostitution. She was named one of Curve Magazine's 10 best activists under 25 in their 2005 issue. And she had recently had a workshop at the National Sex Works Conference in Las Vegas in July. And I guess if all goes well, she's got a feature article coming out in Spread Magazine, which is the New York City-based glossy magazine. I guess it's one of the only of its kind. It's written by and for sex workers. And she has spoken at many, many different events at colleges, presentations at conferences with the press, a lot more than we can get into here about Katie's credentials in history. Welcome to the show, Katie Simon.
Thank you. And actually, it's really personally gratifying to me to hear about the Zyprexa news, because I remember about 10 years ago when I was getting my bright new and shiny diagnosis, I was sent to a hospital called Charles River Hospital, which no longer exists, where no matter what diagnosis you had, at that young adult unit, you came out with a prescription for Zyprexa. And there were jokes about it. Oh, ha, 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 the doctors must be buying stock in Zyprexa. But, you know, now thinking back on that now, I wonder what the actual deal was there. You know, what sort of policy there was that made it obligatory for a bunch of kids, a totally heterogeneous group of kids in terms of class, race, and gender, you know, 20 of them, to be, you know, to all go out there with Zyprexa. It's really interesting.
The leaked documents is definitely, what's in the New York Times is just the tip of the iceberg of this issue, and hopefully there'll be more coverage coming out. For the show tonight, I just wanted to kind of introduce this. We decided on a holiday special about sex, because the holidays are so depressing and conflictual, and people are contacting, you know, their families or back with their families, and that's really where our sexuality gets shaped and the messages that we get. And I think that it's really valuable to turn to people who are considered prostitutes, who are called sex workers, people who are really on the edge and outside of the mainstream, to really talk about sexuality and what is it that's going on. There's sort of like a very hypocritical, almost crazy attitude that we have towards sexuality in our society, one of which is represented by the way in which prostitution is criminalized, just as one example. Another example is the way in which abstinence-only sex education is promoted. And these are all kinds of messages that we get that really drive a lot of us to be very confused and to be very wounded in our sexualities. And then the way in which prostitutes and sex workers have historically been seen as a symptom, that they're doing what they're doing because it's a symptom of something wrong with them. Either they're diseased or pathologized or disordered or all abuse survivors or something like that. And then all these norms get set up, and then that's part of the entire complex of establishing what's healthy and what's sane and then what's diseased and unhealthy. So I just want to turn it over to you, Katie. Just want to speak to some of that and just tell us more about yourself and then what your sort of political perspective on all this is.
Sure. Well, biographically, I came into sex work for the reason that many of us come into sex work for purely economic reasons. I mean, basically, you know, I dropped out of a supposedly, you know, prominent college with a college in which, if I'd kept on going, I would have gotten a liberal arts, would you like fries with that degree anyway. So here I am. I moved into an area where I could be with my friends and with my community, where I thought that I could do more political activism. I'm troweling the town for a retail 40-hour-a-week soul-sucking job that would make me want to, at the end of the day, just, you know, go to sleep and, you know, die and wake up and be resurrected for another day of soul-suckery. So, you know, rather than suffer through that fate, and plus because, you know, we had gotten into the area a little bit too late to be looking for even those jobs, like they were being handed out like prizes, I don't know. I decided, you know, why not work like maybe 10, 20 hours a week at most, and live on a high-end income instead. Do that in exchange for taking the risk of having an illegal job. So I called the Advocates ads they were hiring at the time, and I really took a leap into the dark side. You know, in retrospect, I think that I should have gone through more friendship networks to look for what I was doing. But I was lucky, and I ran into some people that were really good people and were ready to school me in what I was doing and ready to teach me how to be an escort, a good middle-class escort, and, you know, cared for my well-being enough so that, you know, they could show me exactly how to minimize the risks that I was taking in terms of both, legal sanctions and avoiding those, and also in terms of avoiding crazy customers, which actually I was really surprised that the sex workers I was around when I first became a sex worker were most scared of were cops and not, you know, the crazy pervert customer of the public imagination, because it seems like, in point of fact, the worst things that happen to sex workers, you know, the I-95 killer and the Green River killer aside, which are, you know, statistically aberrant, the worst things that happen to escorts, street workers, prostitutes of any economic level come from cops, come from the legal system. So that's one thing I learned. That's how I came into sex work. And as I came into sex work and started doing that work, you know, as a person who was radically politicized at that point on a lot of different issues, it seemed to me to be obvious that this issue needed to be politicized, and in fact had been, that there had been, you know, I started reading up and I realized that there had been, you know, a movement around for at least 20 years. And that movement simply hadn't gotten very far, because even within feminism, there was still controversy within feminism itself about prostitution and sex work. And there was a contingent of feminists like Andrea Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon that thought of prostitutes as victims, thought of prostitutes as exploited women who didn't have agency and who needed to be saved from their choices. Whereas there were also third wave feminists that had a different view of prostitution and saw it as just another choice that a woman could make about her sexuality, but they didn't really have much of a class analysis. They didn't really understand, you know, a lot of these girls were what a lot of people in the movements that I'm around, and the people that I talk to refer to as, you know, the strippers. People who strip for a few months to write their thesis and get a doctoral on human sexuality. Not people who are relying on this as a way to make a living. Not people who really understand the economic underpinnings of prostitution. And not understanding, you know, the problems and the divides between race, gender, and class among sex workers, and the divisions between different kinds of sex workers, like strippers and prostitutes, and the way that that stigma around sex creates these divisions and makes, you know, strippers look down on prostitutes because strippers don't actually go all the way, and makes porn actresses are looked down upon by prostitutes because they don't use condoms even though they get tested. And some of them actually don't get tested and still don't use condoms because they're forced to do so by management. They're told there's a euphemism for it. It's called condom optional contracts. And the option is basically that you can not wear a condom or you don't go to work, basically. So I'm trying to ramble back to where I was going with this. Yeah, so basically, it's not a movement that's, you know, gained a lot of steam. It's not a movement. Our rights have not been included among other people's rights. When people form coalitions, you know, we're not one of the first marginalized groups that's thought of, oh, let's include the sex workers. That's not the kind of thing that happens, you know.
I think that's a real parallel with the psychiatric survivors as well. I mean, we're kind of like, we're the stigmatized, you know, scary, the ones that sort of considered a liability to the, considered a liability to the movement. Well, let's, there's definitely more to get into here. I want to introduce our next guest, who's on the phone from New York City. Her name is Maurice, and she's an organizer. I'll read her bio here. Maurice is an organizer, pervert, artist, ruckus raiser, sex worker, and mad genius from New York City. She is currently working with the Icarus Project, which is a radical mental health support network with local groups around the country, and with the Rock Dove Collective, which is dedicated to the development of radical and free or low-cost health care in New York City. Maurice facilitates a workshop called The Fine Madness of Sexual Perversities and Diversities, and she is spending the month of January, listen to this, she's spending the month of January on a Caribbean island writing her new zine, which is entitled Dirty Little Slut. Maurice, are you there?
I am.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Is there much opportunity to be a dirty little slut in a small Caribbean island?
Well, if you bring your partner along.
Well, listen, it's really great to have you on the show. Why don't you, I know were you able to hear Katie's...
I was, actually, and I was taking notes.
Oh, great.
So much of what she was saying resonated really strongly with my own experiences. So.
Well, take it away. Yeah, how did you get into this, and what are your sort of views on how it all fits together with the larger political issues?
Right, well, let's see, it was interesting hearing Katie talk about, you know, the stripper who takes on the job as a means of getting her diploma. That wasn't exactly my story, but I did actually start stripping when I was in Montreal going to school. And it was a monetary consideration on my part as well, but I have to admit that there's some part of me as a self-identified pervert that actually really enjoys it and enjoys both. You know, I'm a dancer and interested in movement and is really interested in how I can captivate people's attention. So there was a certain part of me that felt really fulfilled by doing that work. And then, let's see, I spent some time, I took a little time off from that, and I went to India and I worked with sex workers there at an AIDS clinic in Pune, specifically for sex workers at a collective called Saheli, which means friend. And it was such an eye-opening experience for me because as opposed to a lot of women I've met while doing sex work, which has expanded to include having done dom work and most recently sort of a combination between doing dom work and foot modeling, which is a whole other interesting little niche into itself.
Now, dom work is where it's a legal thing where you're hired to humiliate your customers, usually men, is that right?
Usually men, yeah.
People can be bothered about the whole legal aspect of the work because sometimes there are these lines that people can cross, like, you know, like body worship, quote-unquote, is a euphemism sometimes clients use when they want the dominatrix to go beyond the legal limit and,
right.
You know, if they want cunnilingus to take place, for example.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's really interesting. Euphemism in language, I think, is a really fascinating part of the work that I do and that I think some of us do. But going back to that, you know, my experience in India was one of saying, oh, wait a second, here's solidarity, you know, which is not to say that there weren't cleavages, but in a society that is so divided by caste, by religion, and that sort of thing, sex workers were among some of the few people who actually came together, you know, and who were like, yeah, we get that shit, we, you know, really have problems here, and we have a hard time in society. Let's bind together and let's see what we can do. We're talking about, like, a collective food kitchen. We're talking about daycare. We're talking about, like, really serious bartered mutual aid. And then when I came back and I moved to New York City, I was appalled about what I saw, and truly the cleavages and the way that we, you know, look down upon each other, even within women in the same industry. Oh, she does this. Oh, you know, mm-hmm. that client's a pervert. That must mean that she's, you know, a bad woman. It's amazing, and it's something that I really am thankful for. You know, the like Katie was saying, there are women who've been working for decades to do something about it, to change where we're coming from and how we approach each other. And I think Spread Magazine is actually one of the really awesome things that's happening right now, that's coming from a younger generation of sex workers that's saying, let's try and create community around these issues. And right now we're talking about having a radical sex worker support group in New York, which would be something that would be very exciting for me. So the work that I'm doing right now is looking at sort of what, in my experience, has been a really positive thing. Certainly there have been times when I've been less than comfortable with what's transpired, but that's largely been because of my own judgment mistakes. And for me, I actually do feel really grateful for what sex work has done for my own approach to my sexuality and to my approach to perversity and, you know, sadomasochism and all of those sorts of things. Because if one is going to come and be supportive of a person as a sexual being, one indulges or steps into the world of the pervert, of which I, you know, I use that term with pride, because when we move forward into that, we take aside all of our prejudgments, because our society is so ready to damn those who don't conform, you know. However, it's important to note how fluid it is and how I do feel like there's a lot more room opening up. You know, 50 years ago, oral sex was something that could land you in jail. And it still, you know, occasionally rules pop up that are still in the books and are used to ostracize queer folk and that sort of thing. It's getting better. But it's not to say that we don't have so far to go.
Yeah, it makes me think of there's a reality TV show that people may know of that was done. I think it was one of the legal brothels in Nevada. And obviously there are a lot of problems about the legal brothel system, which enriches the owners of the brothel, which are usually not the women who work there. But it was really interesting because they showed the clients coming in and negotiating with the women who were providing sex. And it was really interesting because you just really got a sense of consent, of empowerment, of open communication, of shamelessness. They were just talking about whatever weird thing that they wanted. Well, that's not okay. I'm not comfortable with that. Okay, that's okay. We can do that. And it just made me feel like, in a sense, there's a challenge to the sexual hypocrisies that I think sex work presents. And can you say something about that, of how the stigma operates and why is it that society might be really interested in suppressing sex work at the same time it's interested in suppressing empowerment and control over sex?
Well, I mean, if I can just speak to that, I feel very much like, and I've been told by clients time and time again, oh my goodness, you're the first person that I've been able to talk about this with. You really understand me. We're talking about actual serious connections. I feel like I'm doing a form of social work when I teach somebody that it's okay if he wants to wear hot pink silk panties, you know, that's okay and that's great. I feel like it's so marginalized and it's so pushed under the surface because it doesn't reflect a homogenous society. And we've long been told that in order to preserve order, we've got to be all the same. You know, this is something that my friends talk a lot about, is monoculture just in the same way that we have these giant agribusiness fields of corn that are easy to preserve but will fail if we don't have the right pesticides and technologies to go along with them? We also have a sexuality that's manufactured and is much easier to control if we have a homogenous sort of desire.
And historically, women who would be considered sex workers or temple prostitutes were healers. Is that sounds like a lot of what you're... Is that even your experience as well, Katie, that's often a very positive thing for some of the clients sometimes?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, there have been people, like the other week or so ago, I saw my first adult baby, which is what the community of people that get, you know, a feeling of arousal from pretending, from playing at these scenes of, you know, being a baby and putting on diapers and usually working, you know, around urination scenes and things like that. You know, I saw my first adult baby and the, you know, definitely the look in his face and the way his personality transformed and the kind of look of relief that he had after that scene was something that was incredible to witness. And certainly sex workers can be healers. Sex workers can be teachers. I remember when I first started going around, I think that I must have like taught maybe 60, 70, 80 people about the existence and the use of dental dams. when I first started escorting and with the year that I turned 21.
I have to say the sex workers that I know have been most fastidious about safe sex practices of anybody I've ever met.
So. Which is why it's ridiculous. And this is, you know, this is reported on even in the first big publication of the movement, which is the Sex Work Anthology by Priscilla Alexander in 1981, that There is no proof that prostitutes were any sort of vector for AIDS. And in fact, if any sort of AIDS transmission was going to be going on, it would be most likely the client to the prostitute, since most prostitutes were women, and clients were much less likely to know about and practice safer sex practices unless they had, you know, learned from what their prostitutes had taught them. So, you know, yet again, it's the stigma around us. And I wanted to say something to what Nerys had spoken about earlier. I'm sorry, am I getting your name wrong? It is Nerys, right?
Nerys.
Nerys? Okay.
Yes.
Could you spell it for me?
M-A-R. Y-S-E.
Maurice? Maurice?
Nerys, actually.
Nerys, okay. All right, I think I got it.
Great.
All right. Well, I think what you were talking about, the realm of the pervert, it's interesting because I think that every single ideological system that promotes the stigma around the prostitute is a system that wants to control sex, that wants to define sex, that wants sex to signify one thing. You know, it's like, you know, in patriarchal times, pre the women's movement, sex was about having a baby. Sex was procreational, and you know, you looked up and you thought of England, and you went through the experience, and you know, whatever, and you did it for that reason. Then post-feminism, it was all right for women to be to enjoy sex suddenly. And in some periods, it was all right for them to, in some places and in some ideological backgrounds, it was okay for them to enjoy it if they were having it with their husband. Then it was okay for them to enjoy it if they were doing it with someone that they loved. Then it was okay for them to go pick up a one-night stand. But then as soon as it was their sexuality and they wanted to turn it into a commodity, you know, then it wasn't okay because that was just not something that they wanted women to own that completely, that we could actually say, this is my sexuality and I want to sell it. You know, it reminds me of the Anti-Sex League in 1984.
The Junior Anti-Sex League,
yeah. Which is, and you know, at the end of the book, Winston's asking one of the heads of that government, of that totalitarian government, why the Junior Anti-Sex League, and they say because it's a force that's too powerful for us to control, and so we'd prefer to eradicate it. And it's just, you know, people are always telling you what kind of experience sex should be like for you,
right?
And when you're receiving money for sex, you know, then it's kind of, first of all, it's not, you're definitely not doing it for all these reasons that, you know, they're selling other commodities to you for. You're definitely not doing it, you know, because you want status, because you want love, because you want a husband, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the question is, are you doing it because you're a pervert or a nymphomaniac? That's not right. That's not cool. Are you doing it because it's just a job for you and you want to make money out of it and, you know, you don't care what the person that you're with feels? That's not cool. Are you doing it because you feel like, you know, you have something to teach about sex, which is not something traditionally that you're supposed to teach anybody anything about, which is not something that we should be, like, receiving learning about the, you know, all these things. They're not scenarios that the people that have told us what sex are supposed to mean want to see happening. And so I think that's why the realm of the pervert definitely intersects with the realm of the sex worker. And I think that's why we see so much stigma around sex work. And then, of course, there's the chicken and the egg scenario where, well, why is it that that prostitution and sex work, why are so many prostitutes and sex workers unhappy, you know, especially those who are poor? It's because of the conditions of criminalization, because of the conditions of stigma.
Right.
You know, you say these things are wrong, then you treat these things as if they're wrong, and you smash your big boots on them, and then, you know, and then you blame these people for suffering because, you know, you create conditions up in within which they suffer.
Yeah, and that's one of the mechanisms for that has been psychiatry and therapy and psychology and defining what's normal and what's perverted and not. And actually in the DSM, it took a big struggle to get homosexuality removed, but it's still in there in a different form, and also sexual perversions are still in there.
Right, sadomasochism, I forget the diagnosis code, but it's there.
And gender dysphoria is still there.
And transvestite fetishism, one of my favorites.
Histrionic disorder is still there.
Which, histrionic?
Histrionic personality.
Yeah, that's an update from hysteria. And coming down the pipe soon is the borderline personality disorder has gotten such a bum rap from feminists that they're upgrading now, and it's going to be emotional dysregulation dysfunction disorder.
Oh, it's having emotions when a man doesn't want you to have one.
Right. See the euphemisms coming through? Yeah, I mean, an experience that I have in doing these workshops in which I have people go around the room. I started out the first workshop I ever did and by having people go around the room and say something that they were taught to be ashamed of about their sexuality. Or that they were ashamed of. And, you know, there was quiet at first. And then I came out and said that I had really large labia. And then people went around the room and said things that they admittedly had never said before out loud. Many people. And one woman said that she had never had an orgasm with another person. Mm. And then she repeated to me later, because she's a friend of mine, that just saying that in that room had enabled her to pick somebody up, go home with them that night and have an orgasm. And that it had so much to do with just being able to talk about it. And that feeling of relief, you know, that's something that if I'm not doing sex work, I can just go and have a really good workshop where we all sit around and talk about what perverts we are. Because honestly, there's something that each of us has that society would call sick. There's some approach that we have to sexuality that deviates from the norm. What is the norm anyway?
Do you think that the genie is kind of getting out of the bottle now? Because, I mean, pornography is a huge, huge industry, and there are a lot more. I mean, most of the porn that's out there is just horrible fast food, McDonald's, patriarchal, you know, male-controlled porn. But there are a lot more spaces opening up for all kinds of alternative, radical challenges to the norm. Do you think things are changing, and what's the danger of just the sort of pro-sex, pro-perversions perspective becoming another kind of capitalist market niche where we get to be our sexual selves as long as it is a commodity? I mean, that's that, because we're talking about freeing the marketplace here, right?
I think that you mentioned this idea once, Will, to me, as the whole idea of, like, you know, Mick thongs and Mick breasts, and another word that I can't mention because I'm not sure whether we're allowed to say it.
Yeah, the Happy Meal, right?
Right. Right. The happy meal with your massage and happy ending. But I think, you know, yes, it's true that there's the danger of it becoming yet another appendage of capitalism in terms of sex work if we were to legalize it. But that's why we work for decriminalization, where we have the purveyors, the providers control their own, you know, their own work. And we're not working for what I see as the mix sex approach, which is what I think Nevada is, where the brothel owners control these women's lives. These women's lives have incredibly draconic laws that govern everything they do and say. They're basically imprisoned within those brothels 2 weeks out of every month whenever they're working, and they make up huge monopolies out of the things they need while they're there. For example, their laundry, they have special people within the brothel that are employed to do their laundry for them. And of course, they overcharged them up the wazoo for just, you know, being able to do their laundry and every other little necessity you can think of.
Right.
And once you're registered as a prostitute, that it's very, very difficult to get a passport, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, I think that in decriminalization, you know, and in championing decriminalization specifically, we're looking for, you know, to champion the independent provider's rights. And if you want to work for somebody, that's great, but let's try to do it within small, collective, cooperative organizations, which I think that a decriminalization model would encourage.
Let me throw a devil's advocate perspective out here, which is that there's a lot of concern worldwide about when you have U.S. military bases or you have a lot of globalization going on with tourism, that what you get is these enclaves of sex work, and especially in Asia, and I know this is a problem in Latin America as well. And so is there a kind of first world classist assumption in what we're talking about here, this idea of empowerment and choice when, I mean, how much choice and empowerment do you have when there are these huge globalization economic class forces at work here? Because, I mean, there is a very sizable middle class and even elite prostitution economy in the U.S., but around the world, the economy, the economics that are driving it are really the underdevelopment, poverty, globalization economics.
Right.
Can you guys speak to that? I mean, how do you square your anti-imperialism with your pro-sex worker rights?
Well, I mean, how are those sex workers doing right now when in criminalized environments, those brothels in which children are abused, in Thailand, for example, when, you know, they can't reach out for help because of a criminalized or even like semi-criminalized environment, they can't reach out for help because their very being, their very essence is criminalized. And so they can't get the health care they need. They can't get the options for exit that they need. I think within a decriminalized environment, you'd be seeing a lot better. And I don't think it's just a first world kind of a thing, because I'm not saying let's fight for sex workers' rights in exclusion of all other movements. I'm saying let's work for sex workers' rights while we work to fight globalization, while we fight to create more jobs, more options, more economic options in total, but to also include the economic option of prostitution, you know? And I also wanted to say something really quickly just about, like, the intersect between the psychiatric system and sex work. And then I'll...
If I could speak briefly to that question.
Why don't you talk first and then I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, just in my experience in India, Pune is a city of 3 million and there are 40,000 sex workers confined within a red light district of, you know, probably 12 square blocks. And nearby, 3 hours away, is Mumbai, which actually has 500,000 sex workers. So we're talking about major numbers of people. And I was definitely apprehensive about going over and feeling, oh, you know, I'm so pro-sex worker and, you know, what's it going to be like when I'm over there? The truth of the matter is that many of these women are slaves, are indentured servants. That said, and it's a really horrible, hard thing. And, you know, just as many of the women in Nevada are forced to stay where they are and are totally pushed down by the laws. And what you see happening in India is there's many women being trafficked from Nepal. Husbands will sell their wives. But what you're looking at is it is, in a way, the fact that so many women are slaves is symptomatic of an economic issue, of something, of a society that is deeply patriarchal, that regards women as commodities, that doesn't see female sexuality as being something that belongs to women. And, you know, it really is directly linked to imperialism. And so I do see, like Katie was saying, I see a lot of intersection in the struggle for sex workers' rights and in looking at systems of imperialism and globalization and capitalism and how those play out in the lives of women in the third world.
Katie, you had something you were going to say about the psychiatric system?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Also, just to briefly go on with what Maurice is saying, I think that we need to also look at the fact that you know, a lot of these anti-trafficking organizations that are second wave feminist anti-trafficking organizations
right.
that say intrinsically prostitution is wrong, and that's why, like, and we need to put more money into law enforcement and border crossing, etc., so that we can prevent these, you know, we can solve the suffering of these trafficked women. I think that they're basically sexualizing and titillating the whole issue by not looking at the fact that, well, hello, how many women are trafficked and put into forced labor in terms of migrant work and farm work? You know, if we were to look at those women, which are in much huger numbers, you know, that would be a real anti-trafficking organization. And also, we need to make a distinction between coerced labor, coerced sex work, and which I don't even consider to be sex work at all, but sex slavery, and voluntary sex work.
Right.
Just like we look at that distinction in any work, we see a distinction between slavery and free labor. But yes, about psychiatry and sex work, I think that, you know, it's very, like, whenever we talk about psychiatry, you have to look back at the history of psychiatry and sex work. And in the 1800s, a lot of the population of these workhouses and institutions for women that they had, these prisons and then also these mental institutions that were basically a way to get rid of women that owned land or women that were obstructing whatever men wanted to achieve, a lot of the populations of these kinds of systems of oppression were prostitutes because you know, they were looked at as promiscuous and therefore mad. But as, hello? What just happened here?
Oh, she's there.
Oh, hi, Maurice.
Hi.
So I think, and then as the system grew older, I think that it got more sophisticated in what it had to say about prostitution. And then there was that old male idea that if you're a prostitute, you must be a nymphomaniac, and therefore you must have something wrong. You know, there must be something wrong. There must be some bats up there.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, when I was younger and was a teenager and was diagnosed and institutionalized, I was told that there was something with me because I was regularly sexually experimenting, just as many teenagers do, but because I was a woman, I was promiscuous. And even now, like, when prostitutes just go to therapists on an outpatient basis, I know a friend of mine who's, you know, has a woman, she's going to a therapist, and the woman's basically telling her, there must be something wrong with you, there must have been some kind of child abuse incident early on in your youth that involved men, because otherwise, why would you be doing this for a living? Well, hello, one out of four women are at some point in their lives are abused sexually. That doesn't explain why people choose to work. I think what explains why people choose to do sex work is because it's one of the highest paid, it's the highest paid profession for an unskilled woman. And, you know,
a skilled woman,
definitely, like, there are plenty of skilled jobs that pay a lot less.
Yeah.
And I think that's all I had to say about that.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I mean, I feel like, as somebody who did experience trauma, whose first, you know, major sexual experience was rape, I still resent the fact that people tell me that that's how it plays out in my psyche.
Right.
And above all else, and part of the work that the Icarus Project does is about self-determination of our own mental health and well-being. And so for me, it's a real struggle because I really want to find a therapist. You know?
Right.
I really actually want to be in therapy. But I refuse to be in therapy with somebody who's going to say that my lifestyle is wrong or that it means that there's something wrong with me.
Right.
And across the board, that's what I find.
That's
because
awesome.
I think that people are really threatened by it, and because I think people, you know, I do have a certain part of me that does enjoy it. Does that mean I'm sick? Fuck no. Does that mean that, like, I really like to have sex or that I like sexual attention? Yes. It's a very...
Or maybe you just enjoy your job. Is it
right.
wrong to enjoy your job if you're a sex worker?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a nice thing to actually enjoy your job.
It just reminds me of there definitely was a time when, you know, massage therapists, that women masseuses, women massage therapists, were really, there was a lot of skepticism, like, oh, what are you getting a massage? Oh, what's that all about? And it's a very intimate thing. The clients are usually often naked, and you're touching their whole bodies, and it's a very And now over the years, it's like massage therapy is really kind of an accepted thing. And I think that there are, with any kind of job, there are certainly risks, and there are certain people who are suited to that job and not suited to that job. I mean, retail can be very, very wonderful for some people and very, very stressful for other people. Touching someone else's body can be feel very invasive and difficult for some people. Putting your body on display, having sex with someone, for a lot of people is not going to be the kind of job that's going to make you feel healthy and empowered. But it depends on the person, and I think that really is what the theme here is, the question of self-determination, that it's not for some outside authority to be deciding for you how you want to sort of navigate your own choices around your body. I mean, I know you mentioned sadomasochism, and I know that one of the things that a lot of people experience is that by going, precisely because they have abuse experiences or they have trauma experiences, by playing out power and abuse in a controlled setting where they have control over and they even switch roles, it can be a very powerfully healing thing. And as long as we stigmatize these things as perversions or as weird or as completely, you know, in reenactment, or it's necessarily just, you know, repeating the abuse, we really, I think, deny people the opportunity to explore for themselves and discover powerful healing tools, because sex is extremely powerful and it can be very, very healing if it's done right. And unfortunately, we don't have an open, honest discussion about this enough in our society. I mean, I know I was really kind of pleasantly shocked when I found out that there's more than one mental hospital in Canada where they have a sex room, and the patients can sign up to go into the sex room. There's porn in the sex room if you want it. You can watch videos. You can have conjugal visits.
Wow.
And hey, it's like, I want to have sex. I want to go in the sex room. Now imagine that you're never going to have that in, you know, a mental health facility in the U.S. And why is that hypocrisy? The other thing that occurred to me is that when I was in the mental health system, the level of surveillance is unbelievable. I mean, we used to have these bed checks in the middle of the night where they would go through. They'd suddenly open the door and flash lights on you. Now, how are you going to masturbate in the middle of the night with any kind of privacy? First of all, it's hard to do when there's four other people crammed into this tiny room with you. But if some staff person is flashing a flashlight on you in the middle of the night. So, I mean, there's a tremendous hypocrisy that gets exposed when you start to look at other countries and how they approach these kinds of questions.
That's really funny, Will, because what you're mentioning is actually a topic in a best-selling book set in mental hospitals. In Girl Interrupted, there's actually a discussion among some of the main characters about, you know, do you have to be on 10-minute checks or on 15-minute checks when your boyfriend visits you? Can you manage, you know, can you manage sex in a 15-minute check? Yes, sort of. In a 10-minute check, it has to be a blowjob. Well, I can do a blowjob on 5-minute checks, you know? Yeah, so definitely, like, that. There's been other minds besides ours have delved deeply into this issue, I think I'm trying to say. I see we only have a little bit of time left, so I just want to put in this plug for my organization, Arise for Social Justice, which is a multi-issue low-income rights organization in Springfield. The work that I do for them is around the WISE Committee, which is does work around the issues of criminalized women, and part of our goals are to decriminalize prostitution. A lot of the people that we work with are street workers, and it taught me a lesson when I was a younger, more wet behind the ears, privileged little activist when I came and decided to do work with, you know, people who were lower class, and let them teach me instead of, like, let me organize them.
Right.
But right now, Arise is going through a lot of problems financially, and Michael Ann Busey, who is one of the founding members, Arise came into being when three women on welfare were just chatting around a coffee table. They're going to have a lot of trouble paying their rent for the next few months. So if you could call them either at 413-734-4948, that's 413-734-4948, about donations, or send a donation to and make the check out to Arise for Social Justice, and the donation would be for 91 Rifle Street, Springfield, Massachusetts.
That's a tax deductible donation, I believe.
Yes.
So we just have a few more minutes. Like you said, last minute comments. Katie, Maurice, you want to just provide your your concluding observations or remarks?
I'd love to hear from Maurice because I've just been talking the whole time.
Oh, well, but it's been such a pleasure. It's so nice to get to meet you on the radio. First of all, I'm going to do a couple plugs. The IcarusProject.net, which is very close to my heart. They have discussion forums. So even if you're not in Philly, New York, San Francisco, Minneapolis, or Portland, you can plug in somehow. And also the Rock Dove Collective, which is a project that I'm very excited about. So go and check it out, especially if you're in the New York area.
Does Rock Dove have a website?
RockDoveCollective.org.
And what is Rock Dove about?
What we're doing is setting up service seekers and service providers. Basically, we're hooking up with providers, healers, especially people in non-traditional modalities, mm-hmm. but as, you know, acupuncture, Reiki, massage, yoga, mm-hmm. but also looking at, you know, dentistry and that sort of thing. And we're contacting providers who might be willing to go ahead and provide services for people of low income, or people who have specific needs, queer, Latino, Wiccan, you know, as a therapist. And we're finding these people, and we're connecting service seekers with providers and working out barters. So, say I do medical billing, which I do, I would offer that in exchange for somebody else being able to go and see a dentist. So that's a project that I'm very excited about. On the whole, just to check out, I'm really excited about this work that we're doing, and I'm really excited about exploring the future of sex and madness and how important it is to see the connections between mad pride and pervert pride and all of those who exist on the edges of society and how many linkages and how many responsibilities we have to respect each other's freakiness if we're freaks ourselves.
Maurice, when are you doing your workshop again?
When am I doing my workshop again? Probably not till I get back from the island, so sometime February or March.
And if people want to get in touch with you, they can get in touch with you via the Rock Dove Collective or the Icarus Project.
Yes.
Katie, last words?
Well, it's just been really great meeting you, Maurice, over the radio as well. And I just hope that the sex workers movement becomes more than just a tiny marginalized collection of really hip women and becomes, you know, a bigger part of the feminist movement along with the mad movement, and that we stop being, you know, these sort of esoteric kind of hip little movements that sprang up in the 70s and 80s and haven't really grown much since, but become a huge part of the left.
Great. Well, thank you, Maurice, and thank you, Katie Simon, for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And you're listening to WXOJLP-FM. This has been the Radical Mental Health Collective show. We will be back on next Wednesday at 6 o'clock. And thanks for tuning in.